This is What in the World
on Canada Talks,
Sirius XM 167.
This is the word is coming.
DNA. Certainly not alphabetical order, but arguably in that order, the three most important letters in the alphabet. What do we know about DNA? Well, we know it's a double helix. We know a very small part of it creates proteins, and that's kind of about it. Recently, we mapped the human genome, but even more recently, we've taken that to another level. We're landing on comets these days, so the study of outer space has reached a new level. But what about inner space? Tonight, Dr. Mark Gerstein from Yale University joins us to talk about a new understanding of DNA, how that'll lead to a new frontier in medicine, human evolution, and just exactly what they found in the so-called junk DNA. It is What in the World, Sirius XM, Channel 167.
You're listening to What in the World
with Richard Gardner
on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
And welcome back to the show. If you're a regular listener, you'd probably agree that we talk a lot on this show about, well, what we like to say is the fascinating, the unexplained, and the underexplained. And that's the one I like to underline, because too many things, especially in a crowded information world where you're lucky if there's even a headline about the most recent scientific discoveries among the headlines about Kim Kardashian shoots, Justin Bieber arrests, etc. We've entered into an era, actually we've long been in this era, but it seems to be getting worse, where there's a lot of incredibly important and exciting things happening that aren't just of interest if you're somebody who's a scientist or follows science or studies science, but I would say if you're a living, breathing human being. Most people would agree that if you're going to ask, well, what makes up a human being? Wow, that's a pretty, complex question. Is it a religious thing? Is it a spiritual thing? Is it just a physical thing? But what most people would agree, the DNA plays a pretty big role in what makes us human, and even going to the next step, what makes us us as individuals. But it's been an elusive part of the study of human anatomy and physiology over the years. But human genetics has, like a lot of things in the medical world, taken quantum leaps forward as far as DNA and genes are concerned, the mapping of the human genome. Almost a decade back now, or perhaps a little longer, was a seminal move in human evolution. This allowed us to finally look at the map, so to speak. But maybe something that got less attention, but maybe historically will be looked back on something that was either equally or more significant, is ENCODE. And that is literally creating the encyclopedia of DNA of that map. And it's created essentially a database and a network that's going to allow people going forward to take the incredible findings of the mapping of the human genome and actually put it to work to make the human race better, healthier, etc. The man who was a big part of that project is Dr. Mark Gerstein. He's an American scientist working in bioinformatics. As of 2009, he is the co-director of Yale Computational Biology and Bioinformatics Program. And, you know, you look at, you know, his background, his education, not to say Yale wasn't good enough, but he also graduated summa cum laude from Harvard. He also spent some time at Cambridge. You get the idea. This is somebody that's got the pedigree to lead a group that's part of such a seminal step forward in human history and human science. So I guess without further ado, Dr. Mark Gerstein, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me on.
And again, you know, thank you for taking the time, because obviously it's not like, you know, this is a 9-to-5 job that you have. And I'm sure ENCODE wasn't close to that. Give us an idea of how a project like that manifests once it's sort of greenlit, once the funding happens, to the, you know, sort of from the beginning to, you know, and I'm not saying you necessarily have a eureka moment, but when this sort of comes to the end and you feel we've achieved the objectives.
Well, I don't think there was that much of a eureka moment with the ENCODE project. I mean, this obviously involves a lot of people. And it took place over a very long time, essentially almost from when they finished sequencing the human genome, and they kind of had a picture, or as you said, a sort of map of all of the human DNA. They wanted to interpret this. And, you know, maybe this is sort of like annotating the map with cities, rivers, and so forth. They wanted to understand all the elements in the genome. And so mostly the National Human Genome Research Institute in the United States, but also internationally, many of the countries involved in genomics kind of banded together and kind of created a consortium or a big group to work on this. And, you know, it's a very sort of systematic endeavor. First, there was a pilot project in this where they looked at, say, 1% of the human genome and tried to think about, you know, what you saw in a small bit of the human genome and you know, develop methods, develop analytical techniques, and so forth. And then they scaled that up to the whole genome. They also, in addition to looking at human, looked at model organisms, because these are much more tractable to study. And the same type of thing, they thought about scaling that up. And they also thought about what things in humans were preserved in model organisms. So this took place over quite a bit of time. So say, starting around 2003, up to the current time, which is a little bit more than a decade. And I think the sort of big moment for this project, in a sense, was when they unveiled the annotation of the human genome in 2012. But, you know, the unveiling sort of happened in the publication of the papers on this. But, of course, this took, you know, many, many years to kind of put all this stuff together. So it wasn't really a sort of a eureka-type moment or a particular singular event. It was just a sort of culmination of a lot of work. And then after 2012, the consortium has continued to work on genomics and, in particular, comparing the human genome to the model organism genomes. And so they've had the comparison to very distant organisms, the worm and fly, and they kind of unveiled that a few months ago. And then very recently, they've also had comparisons to the mouse genome. And that's the kind of overall picture. And the annotation effort is going to continue on, certainly for a number of years. And I think the focus more and more is to get practical applications from this, you know, to sort of see how it's useful in disease studies, to see how the annotation is useful for understanding human variation and in various practical contexts.
And I'm guessing, you know, you're at a cocktail party and you're talking to people from different walks of life. They ask you about something like this, and I'm assuming that conversation is always going to get to, you know, so what is the, you know, why is this important? What is the practical application? How is this going to help me down the road? It would seem that the low-hanging fruit or the initial default response would have to be, like you said, research into disease, understanding the role that genetics play in disease, and being able to potentially, you know, I don't want to say like, you know, splice genes, et cetera, and be able to, you know, get rid of cancer genes. But this type of information and understanding it, what do you see in terms of what that's going to be able to help researchers like yourself and other scientists do that is specific to disease research?
Sure. No, I think it's going to be very helpful for disease research, and that's probably the principal reason that they funded this big endeavor. The basic idea is that, you know, people differ in their genomes. Now, the basic structure of everyone's genome is about the same. It's about 2 copies of 3 billion characters each. But, you know, people have all sorts of single nucleotide differences and also block variants in their genome. And these variations give rise to propensities to maybe contract a certain disease and so forth. And however, that's just a statistical thing. You see that lots of people with this particular variant tend to have a disease. If you want to actually treat the disease, design a drug, understand what the disease is doing, you have to understand the molecular basis. You know, what is that variant doing? And that's what really ENCODE lets you do. It lets you go from the variants in individual people to starting to think about the molecular basis of what's going on. You know, is a gene being upregulated? Some important molecule being disrupted, and so on and so forth. Now, in cancer, it's even more specific, because in cancer what happens is the genome itself gets mutated and messed up. And so in addition to the underlying variation in a person, that's called the germline variation, in cancer you have additional variation, variation called somatic variants. And ENCODE lets you interpret what these somatic variants are doing. You know, if a particular region of a chromosome is deleted or duplicated, you can start to understand, well, what is on that chromosome? What has happened? What functionally might be the manifestation? And that's the motivation for the creation of this resource.
Is there the possibility of somebody being, let's say, predisposed, as they say, to a specific disease, let's say cancer, being able to identify that literally after birth and actually do something about it?
Sure. No, I think that's definitely the motivation. I mean, the motivation is to look at people's individual variants and realize that, you know, some of these variants might have an effect, a strong effect during their life. And a lot of times if you deal with things very early on, you know, you can take very preemptive action before, you know, anything major has happened. I mean, the extreme of this, of course, is where you see this breast cancer associated gene like BRCA1, BRCA2, and so forth, you know, being associated with cancer, and people, you know, wanting to have preemptive mastectomies and so forth if they feel they have the deleterious variant. Now, that's a little extreme, but you could certainly imagine more and more people having kind of progressively customized and personalized medical treatment based on their genetic proclivities.
Why do you think people, I don't know what your experiences is, but I know mine when talking about these types of things, because it's interesting. You just touched on what we all are pretty much aware of these days, is that the earlier you catch something, obviously it gives you a better shot. So this is why we go in and get our prostate checked, et cetera. So we understand that the earlier the better for identifying something that, so, you know, it's not too far down the road if indeed you do get cancer. But then if you extrapolate that question to, well, imagine a day where literally out of the womb, you know, all your genetic work would be done, that information would pop up immediately, and you'd be able to have doctors already working on, you know, whether it be a prescribed treatment or a lifestyle or whatever it might be, to be able to, you know, ensure that you don't that gene or that disease doesn't ultimately manifest, which sounds pretty cool, doesn't it? I mean, it sounds like a pretty positive step forward. Yet I find the people I talk to, once you get into that world, this is where people start to get uncomfortable. This is where you start to hear about the term playing God. Where like, what's your experience with that? And what do you tell people at this so-called cocktail party that I invented earlier?
I certainly worry about that too, and I think, you know, genetics, you know, has a very there's a lot of very tricky ethical issues in genetics, and you have to be very conscious of that. I certainly worry about that. Now, I think treating a person very early on for their particular genotype or variants, you know, that maybe that you could say there's some tricky ethical issues there, but by and large, I think that isn't so problematic. Like, the really problematical things start to become in terms of thinking about selecting one's spouse in terms of genetics, or, you know,
the old the Gattaca world, I guess.
Yeah, that type of thing, or screening potential embryos. That stuff gets very tricky, and you know, conceptually it's possible, though, you know, I think a lot of people really would not be sure this is a good thing.
But it's interesting because we don't have a lot to base that on, and it just opens up this wide ethical, conundrum. But like you said, I mean, from a rational standpoint, you can see that, you know, there'd be a lot of benefits to, you know, early genetic diagnosis, let's say. But it's almost like we don't trust ourselves, right? It seems like we're you know, we don't feel we have a good track record as a species with these incredible, sort of keys to knowledge, and especially when it has to do with medical or scientific knowledge. Is there? But at the same time, the level of depth that people like yourself are going into is pretty incredible. If we've mapped the human genome, if we've developed the encyclopedia now for the human genome or, you know, DNA, what then do you anticipate to be that next big frontier?
Well, I think certainly there's, you know, I should say additional refinement of this encyclopedia. But I think the next big frontier is really where you take the understanding that you get from say, ENCODE or these elements, you know, what these elements are doing, and then relate them to an individual person's genome. Because where the personal genome is a little different from the, say, map of the globe, is that there's one map of the globe, and, you know, when you map it, you're sort of done. Okay, and in a sense, that was the initial attitude in genomics in, say, 2003. We've mapped the genome, the reference genome of a person, we're done. But the reality is, everyone has a slightly different genome. You know, as I said, we differ in these individual, what's called point mutations in our genome, where one base has changed. We also have blocks in our genome, shuffled and so forth. And so the ideal situation is you'd have the sequence of the individual person's genome, the what's called the personal genome. And the idea of the personal genome was really thought of as science fiction, even as late as 10 years ago, just because it's so expensive to sequence all of a person's DNA. But now, with the incredible drop in the price of sequencing, it's completely conceivable to sequence individual people's genomes.
Okay, let me, and that's a perfect segue. I'm going to stop you right there because we have to take a break. I want to go deep into that because that is, again, this is the next frontier. This is where this gets really interesting. More with Dr. Mark Gerstein on the other side of the break. It is What in the World, Sirius XM, channel 167.
Shoot.
Welcome back to What in the World with Richard Gardner
on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
And we are with Dr. Mark Gerstein of Yale University, co-director of ENCODE. Is that accurate?
No, I wouldn't say I'm the co-director of ENCODE. I'm the co-director of the Yale Computational Biology Program, and I'm one of the many leaders of ENCODE. Co-director is a little strong.
Okay, so I'll just sort of give people a brief overview for if you're just joining us. The ENCODE essentially is the acronym for the Encyclopedia of DNA Elements. The project is the effort of hundreds of scientists to describe the workings of the human genome. Their research, outlined in 30 papers published in multiple journals, has confirmed our genome is far more complex than originally thought. And I don't think that's the last time we'll say that in human history. Regions that contain instructions for making proteins, which carry out life's functions, account for only about 1% of our genome. ENCODE has shed light on the other 99%. We're going to go down that a little further as we continue. But before the break, we were talking about this very sort of interesting and, you know, you use the term sort of sci-fi world, or at least vision, where the personal DNA of me, of you, of anybody else listening, almost ends up being our medical file, I guess, right? Like where you'd almost be carrying around a card and this is my particular code, and I'm guessing like a fingerprint, each one is unique to each of us. And when you sort of think about this rationally, it really does open up an entirely mind-boggling world of medicine that would be beyond accurate, because right now, for the most part, medical science is very much driven by the diagnosis, right? And the diagnosis is very much a great educated guess by a doctor to try to listen to your symptoms, do some blood work, do some other things, but really, you know, not necessarily throwing darts, but certainly not incredibly specific. This, I'm guessing, would really take a lot of the guesswork out of diagnosing people going forward. Is that a fair assessment?
Well, yes, I think it would certainly help with diagnosing people, but I don't think it's going to be such a qualitative difference in that, you know, when people do blood work and all, they measure the particular metabolites and things floating around in your blood, or they do other tests, they measure things about your body, and those really do point to very specific mechanistic things, you know, that you can get in normal medical practice. I think what ENCODE is going to do is going to help interpret that and give it context, and sort of also say, well, geez, you know, you have high cholesterol, or you know, you have a particular abnormality. Maybe we can see some hints in your genome as to why that's the case, or you know, in your underlying code. And I should say that, you know, there is definitely the sense that your 6 billion letters of DNA are essentially the ultimate code for a person. I think that's pretty true. And, you know, it's a big data set, you know, big data in a real sense, but it's quite ultimate. It's, you know, it's more fundamental to a person than, you know, almost anything else, except for maybe their connectome, which is imagined to be their set of connections in their brain that sort of governs all their memories and so forth. And so I read a book recently where a very eloquent writer was saying that a person is a genome and a connectome, a sum of a person. And, you know, maybe, you know, and to go even more science fiction-wise, in this particular book, they were talking about, well, in the future, you know, if you wanted to preserve a person, you know, you would preserve these 6 billion characters of DNA, and then you could preserve, in theory, all their neural connections, which is much more ambitious than just the characters of DNA. But somehow that bit of information, that information matrix, really gets a lot of at the heart of what a particular individual person is. And I think that is really neat, you know, sort of getting at the informational fundamentals of a person.
Well, it feels dramatic in that, like I just read the other day, they're very seriously thinking about cloning a woolly mammoth.
Uh-huh.
You know, like, and again, we could talk all day about what the potential, you know, Jurassic Park level ramifications are of these types of things. But what we know now is that essentially, you know, you get the you get a very small sample of DNA. You're able to physiologically, at least potentially, or theoretically, recreate, clone somebody or some, let's say, an animal, a sheep. We're comfortable with that. And we had Michio Kaku on, Dr. Michio Kaku, on a few shows ago, and he's talking now about just essentially downloading your neurological hard drive at the end of your life, and not talking about it theoretically. He's talking about it in terms of when we'll be able to do that fully. But there's no question in his mind that we will be at some point going to maybe a library. I'll pull out the file, the Mark Gerstein file, and every single memory and experience you've ever had is downloaded into some sort of, you know, USB or whatever. And I would theoretically be able to pump that into who knows what, and I'd be able to ask that memory stick questions that only, you know, that Mark Gerstein would be able to answer. Now, you want to talk sci-fi, that's sci-fi. But I'm guessing that, you know, what you touched on in the book you're reading recently, it's not hard to at least theoretically envision someday where the combination of the DNA plus the download, that you'd be able to create, again, essentially replicas of you and me. Is that crazy talk?
Well, that was the thesis in this particular book. I think now I'm remembering, I think this book actually was called Connectome by Sebastian Sung, a very good book. And that was the thesis. Now I have to say that I think that all the neural information, I mean that is science fiction. I mean that you cannot do that now, and I think that there's going to be a lot of hills to, you know, to cross, or, you know, mountains to cross till people get there. But the genome really is something that you can do. I mean, that is, that's not science fiction. That's more of almost, you know, engineering. I mean, if you want and you want to open your wallet up and pay, you can get your genome. And there's a lot of people that do, just for recreation.
Wow, right now.
Yeah, no. Even for your own personal amusement, you know, depending on how much you want to spend, you can get a kind of low-res version of your genome, you know, which is kind of a sample that particular things, or you can get a high-res genome, basically almost, you know, all your bases. You know, it's going to cost you a few $1,000, but that's not that much. And, you know, and then you can sit there and look at, you know, who you are. It's sort of like looking at yourself in a new type of mirror. I think a lot of genomics has a lot of the metaphors of a new type of imaging technology. It's as if, you know, they discovered X-rays and suddenly people could look inside themselves and see something. You know, wow, I can see my bones. I can see all these things now. Now they could take pictures, you know, through the X-ray. And now you have this sense of being able to take these DNA pictures and, you know, get a portrait of each person. And, of course, you know, in DNA, just like in the normal world, you know, people look sort of similar. I mean, but they're differences. And of course, you know, since we all are very used to our similarities, we tend to focus, you know, in a sense, sometimes on the differences. But those are interesting to people. And I think beyond the medical aspect of things, there's just the pure human interest in that's an individual person's genome. You know, that's my genome. Mm. And, you know, what do those differences mean? And one thing I'm particularly interested in, which is a non-medical type of things, I'm very interested in sports genomics and sports genetics. And, you know, my idea is that in the future, you're going to see more and more people when they train or when they try to get their body to do something different, they're not going to do it in a completely generic way, but they're going to really think more and more about, you know, what type of genes do I have? What type of alleles? Do they give me certain propensities for certain types of sports? You know, strength sports, endurance sports, and so forth. And they're going to think, you know, when they train, you know, about maybe sort of changing their, not so much their genome, but changing their gene expression or changing their methylation state and so forth, you know, focusing on maybe, molecular endpoints as opposed to physiological endpoints. And I think that it's not necessarily a medical thing, but I think that people will be very interested in that because, you know, anyone who's trained very intensely for a sport, you know, they want to get every possible advantage they can. And a lot of those advantages come from really customizing what you're doing to who you are. You know, I mean, obviously, you know, if you're Michael Phelps, you know, you don't want to be putting on, you know, little tiny gloves or, you know, because you're not going to fit, you know, so you have to kind of customize, you know, the things you wear and the things you do to who you are.
Well, I'm sure there's people writing your name down right now, possibly baseball players thinking, so they might, you might be getting a call because as we know, the history of not only athletics, but competition, to your point, the smallest edge, people will do whatever they can to get it. And I don't think you're wrong about that at all. I think this and more applications going forward, depending on what country, depending on what industry, let's say, and, you know, certainly where we are in the future. But it does bring us back to sort of the present. And in the not too distant future, you know, we're making a lot of leaps and bounds these days as it pertains to measurement, right? I mean, MRI was a huge leap. And, you know, obviously now we're into quantum microscopes. And it seems that's where the leaps happen. When you go back and look at these sort of really big progressive steps in science, it was about a new either technology or a new, you know, a telescope that allowed us to see further or a microscope that allowed us to see deeper. But in this case, with what you guys were doing, because I think it's inaccurate to say you guys created the encyclopedia, because for a lot of people, the encyclopedia, you remember it as, okay, we go to the encyclopedia, A is whatever, albatross or whatever, and on to abacus or whatever. That's not even alphabetical order, but you get my idea. You guys didn't just lay this out sort of that way. This is networked in a way that is going to allow, I think, the researchers going forward to really understanding how the interdependence works. Is that fair?
That's true. Though I do think I do think your initial analogy of just a new measuring technology and the new ability to deal with the measurements is very accurate for a lot of genomics. The sequencing technology in the last few years has really progressed, you know, truly dramatically. I mean, you know, people often talk about how it's far outstripped Moore's law, which is the exponential increase in computer power.
Wow, really?
Much, much faster than that. And like I said, you know, 10, 15 years ago, it cost, people have different estimates of this, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars, maybe even more, to sequence the first human genome. And now it's thousands, you know, it's many, many, many orders of magnitude cheaper. And then in addition, of course, now we have the ability to manipulate that data. I mean, you know, 10, 15, 20 years ago, dealing with very big data sets, you know, especially in a personal context, you know, for individual people was just impossible. And now, you know, just like we do with images, it's a trivial thing. And I think the confluence of the ability to deal with large amounts of information and the ability to get just extract tremendous amounts of sequencing information from people really cheaply is a main thing behind genomics. And it's pure technology. It's just very much like, you know, the way Leeuwenhoek, you know, discovered the light microscope, or, you know, Bragg or something discovered X-ray crystallography. This is it's all like a ability to see something. And you can now see all your DNA bases. And now this is a little less interpretable than when you look through a microscope and at least you see something that sort of looks like an image, but it has really the same idea. And I think that the people essentially now are they have this new ability to look at things, and then the question is, with this new data, what to do? And the way you put it, I think is actually quite accurate. This is very common in science. People develop a new way of seeing things, and then there's this phase where, like, suddenly there's these new pictures, you know, like just MRI. There's suddenly people can visualize, you know, the brain of a living person, and they can see it. And then, you know, there's this big question of what does it mean? What do I do with it?
Which is equally important because, again, yeah. I mean, if you can't make sense of things, it's not going to help you. And if it's overwhelming, it can potentially have the reverse effect. We're going to continue after the break with Dr. Mark Gerstein. We're talking DNA. We're talking ENCODE. We're talking the future. Humanity 2.0. It is What in the World? Sirius XM, channel 167.
We're people gonna rise up and take what's there. Don't you know you better run, 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 run. Destroys the night, night divides the day. Try to run, try to hide, break on through to the other side. Break on through to the other side. Break on through to the other side, yeah.
Here's Richard Gardner with What in the World on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
And welcome back to the show. We're with Dr. Mark Gerstein of Yale University. And we're talking about the work of ENCODE, which is, of course, the Encyclopedia of DNA, which is, you know, sort of the extension of the Human Genome Project that perhaps you've heard of. And this is taking it to the next level. Now taking that information that was accrued over, I think, about 10 years and, like you said, a few hundred million dollars, and is now making sense of it and allowing researchers going forward to do all sorts of incredible things, because now they almost have a GPS. They can sort of navigate because the roads are now visible. It's not just, I guess the analogy you used, Dr. Gerstein, was that the other was a picture of the Earth or the world map, let's say. What you guys have done is add the roads, add the lakes, add the rivers. Is that fair?
No, that's completely correct. I mean, I think it's, you can think of it as, you know, someone... Well, it's very easy to imagine. It's almost like the original genome thing was just sort of taking a picture of the world from afar. And you know, you'd see it, and that's a big deal. You know, you just have all the pixels in a picture, and in the DNA picture, you have all the bases. And it's actually a very similar thing, because in the DNA picture, you have about 3 billion bases, and, you know... 3 billion is probably pretty large for a picture, but you know, it's like a very, very super high resolution. It's called gigapixel resolution. You can take a picture with that resolution. But then, you know, the question is, what does it mean? What are all those things mean? You know, is a particular spot someplace? Is it, you know, a center of activity? You know, is this where? How are things connected? Are there roads between them? You know, is this particular thing here a state, or, you know, as a region, a particular contiguous region, you know, that's...
Yeah, land or water, like, I mean, I guess all things, the map analogy kind of applies across the board.
Yeah, no, that's completely correct. In fact, I mean, actually, just to even go further, is like the immediate division between land and water on a map, you know, maybe would be sort of related. When you look at the genome, you could divide it into regions that are kind of active and regions that are kind of closed off. And and those regions change in different cells. And, you know, and I think that would be an immediate thing you would do. And then you'd maybe say, oh, here are the genes. And maybe those are like the cities or, you know, some sort of key points. And then you might find the places where the genes are regulated, you know what I'm saying? And those are maybe... related to the connections between cities or the, you know, sort of areas around them or something like that that provide, you know, natural resources and, you know, people that go into them and so forth. And I think that a lot can be done with that particular particular analogy.
And from that standpoint, because what got a lot of play and a lot of headlines when this ultimately was sent out, you know, published, but also picked up by the New York Times and pretty much every other media organization in North America, but around the world. Junk DNA was a big part of what the interpretation was, that essentially one of the big discoveries or takeaways from this work was understanding that this so-called DNA that people refer to as junk DNA that doesn't create proteins, so we're always scratching our heads as to what it did. That's not entirely accurate, because I think yourself and other people had talked to the fact that you clearly knew it had some relationship, some important, significant relationship with the protein creating genes, etc. But so I guess... For the record, let's put this to rest once and for all. What was the significant change in understanding of junk DNA that came out of the ENCODE project?
Well, I think that unfortunately, I think that the junk DNA thing became kind of the junk of this project. I mean, it sort of took a life onto its own, and you know, in some caricatures, people would have said, "Oh, you know, ENCODE showed that there's no more junk in the genome," and that's not true. And it's sort of a caricature of what happened. But I think the way this kind of at least came about is that up to the time of, say, the annotation of all of the genome, you know, people tended to focus on genes. I mean, they knew that there was other things in the genome, but, you know, they tended to focus on genes. And it's sort of like the analogy I sometimes like to use, which is a very politically charged one, is the 1%, you know, when you talk about the country, 1%. You know, but it's sort of similar in the sense you have 1% of the genome is genes. Okay, and so people would, those were the best annotated things. Those are the things that people were most comfortable ascribing functions to. And, you know, they didn't have as good of a grasp of what's going on in the rest of the genome. That doesn't mean they had no grasp, but they didn't have as good of a grasp. And consequently, ENCODE's real thrust was not so much on improving the gene annotation. It did some of that, but that wasn't its thrust. Its thrust was really to try to make sense of all this other bits of the genome, you know, the regions between the cities and so forth that people hadn't focused on. And so, you know, that's kind of what the project kind of hailed as its big achievement, and I think it was its big achievement, making a resource that helped interpret this. Now, did people think before the project that all the regions between genes were functionless junk? No, that's definitely not true. People certainly knew that there were all sorts of things going on. Did they have a comprehensive map of, you know, what those regions were? No, they didn't. And I think the project provided a resource.
So just to extrapolate that a little bit, because a lot of the sort of anecdotal narrative around that was it had been dismissed as irrelevant. And what you're saying is that was really never the case. It was more to TBD. We know it's relevant. We know it's significant. We just don't know how yet, but we'll get there.
Yes, I think it's more that, you know, people had a lot of these ideas that there were things that were important in the non-coding regions of the genome. They'd studied some of them, but they didn't have a map for them because it's just a lot of work. I mean, doing it, if you just the simple 1% to 99% encapsulates, you know, just a lot of the issues. I mean, if you've been focusing most of the time on 1%, you know, scaling up to 99%, it's just a lot of work. You know, it's a lot of stuff to do. And I think a lot of what ENCODE did was provide some element of a map for that 99%. And it showed that there was a lot of the 99% that was apparently doing something. You know, what fraction of it is really doing something very important versus not is a bit debatable. But, you know, I think that was one of the big achievements of the project. Now, another interesting aspect, though, is that in terms of where the word junk comes from, there's this idea which is a little separated from ENCODE, it's a little different, but very, very important idea in biology that, you know, things that are important are under what's called selection. That means they're kind of preserved in the genome and preserved through across the human population, through many generations. They're also preserved across different organisms. So if you look, for instance, at a gene, it's doing something, and you can look and you can find that gene in a chimpanzee, you can find that gene in a mouse, and, you know, maybe the gene will even be conserved all the way down in some form to a fly or a worm and so forth. But a region of the genome that maybe isn't doing something, you know, I don't want to say as important, but as kind of universal, you won't see that level of conservation, or you won't see that preservation. And, you know, one of the sort of mysteries of the genome is that if you look at that 99% of non-coding things, only a fraction, a very small fraction of that 99% really has very strong selection on it, like genes do. And so that you know, some people would say, well, that means that it's just evolving neutrally, and from the perspective of evolution, it's not really being preserved, conserved. It's not important. You know, and other people will say, well, that's not necessarily true. It could still be doing something, even if it's not conserved the same way. And so I think a lot of the debate centers on kind of how to think about this evolutionarily. And one thing that is interesting in this is you have to bring in other organisms. But, you know, one of the interesting paradoxes of genomics is if you say, take the human genome and, oh, I don't know, I think it's the pufferfish genome or something like that, or, you know, other, or they have, you know, sometimes very similar numbers of genes. For many of the genes, you can match them up really well. And, but, you know, a lot of the non-coding regions in, say, some of these other organisms' genomes are gone, or they're really deeply shuffled. And you know, so a lot of people would look at that and say, you don't really need all those non-coding regions to get a functional organism. And I think that's the center of a lot of this controversy, or sometimes some of the controversy. You know, to what degree are those things doing functionally important things for the organism? And that's still an open question.
Well, and a lot of these, I mean, again, we're not solving this stuff tonight, nor are you guys solving it in the next, days, months, or years. But you're closer to answering questions that we've been looking for a long time. And this is how it goes. This is how we continue to do what we can with what we have. Last break, and then we're back for a couple of minutes with Dr. Mark Gerstein. It is What in the World, Sirius XM, Channel 167.
Happy birthday.
You're listening to What in the World
with Richard Gardner
on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
And yeah, our last segment, a short segment, unfortunately. And again, this is the type of stuff that we're probably just scratching the surface of. But, for more information about, before I forget, Dr. Gerstein, where can people go if they want to learn more about this, the work you guys have done and are doing?
The ENCODE project has a website. If you just Google ENCODE project, you'll find it. It's encodeproject.org, and that basically has links to, you know, lots of the information about this. The NHGRI, which is the National Human Genome Research Institute, they're at genome.gov, and they have a lot of resources on genomics. And a lot of the specific things that I personally work on related to genomics are available through my own personal lab's website, which is gersteinlab.org, just my name, lab.org.
So all you budding genetics freaks, obviously the information is out there and it's more incredible than ever. I discourage all supervillains from checking out this information because we don't want that. We don't want to spur the next supervillain to be creating a, some sort of cyborg in 20 or 30 years. But with a couple of minutes left, you know, I think there's very few things that leak into the mainstream. You know, CERN, obviously, the God particle, people got their heads around why that was important. You know, we land on a comet. People pay attention to that for a couple of days at least. But about a minute left, what is the legacy, do you think, of ENCODE? What do you expect or hope the legacy will be in 20 years, 100 years?
Well, I think the legacy is going to be a very practical legacy. I mean, ENCODE is about not so much a discovery, it's about creating a resource. And so the legacy will be hopefully a resource that people are going to use. And in particular, I think the big way they're going to use it is to interpret personal genomes. People are going to be interpreting their personal genome just for fun. Like I said, they're going to be, you know, looking at their sequence and trying to understand why they're a fast runner or a slow runner and how their variants are affecting their metabolism, or they're going to be doing it in a medical context, you know, and maybe unfortunately they're going to contract cancer and their genes get a little messed up and they're going to want to understand, how it's got messed up, and a doctor hopefully will be able to customize particular drugs to treat, say, cancer based on how the genome is mutated. And I think that's going to be a very practical legacy, frankly, a lot more practical probably than the landing on the comet. I do think the goal of ENCODE is really to create a practical resource. It's less a discovery thing, and it's more of creating a kind of technological platform, that people could use. And, you know, the mindset is really that we're going to have all these personal genomes in the future, and people are going to be interested in their own variants because it's just fundamental information about themselves, and they're going to want to know what they mean. And this this resource is really aimed at giving you a molecular understanding of what a variant does. Now, that doesn't mean today you can dial in a variant and really get a completely comprehensible understanding, but you have the beginnings of that, and the thought processes with the framework keeps evolving over time. People are going to get better understanding of their own personal genome.
Which can only lead to positives for you, me, everybody listening. We really appreciate your time. Keep up the great work. Dr. Mark Gerstein, you can check him out. Again, you Google him in Yale, Google him in ENCODE. You'll find his work. Thanks for joining us tonight. Thanks for listening, everyone. It is What in the World, Sirius XM, channel 167.
One day, said the world is a place that you can't survive without faith. Sometimes in my tears I drown, but I never let it get me down. So my negativity